I think the main way of learning things is to be driven by problems. The main heart is really that of breaking the problem into a simpler one. Failing and doing mistakes is the most important thing. A PhD is more about developing a set of skills to solve big problems. YouTube videos nowadays, you can find an impressive amount of material. There is no conservation law that can tell you this is a cat, this is a dog. And what is the difference between PIV and PTV? But you criticize without really saying, oh, this is not really good. Controlling a flow is not like playing chess. People not understanding enough.
Miguel, welcome to the show. It's really a pleasure to be here at VKI in your office. Thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for coming and thank you for having me. It's my pleasure and a big honor to be in your podcast.
Thank you so much. I think we had like a half an hour discussion already in the cafeteria to talk about life, business, data-driven fluid mechanics, etc. But maybe tell people, who are you in the first place? Who's Miguel? What is your background? What do you actually do here at VKI?
Yeah, so I'm a mechanical engineer. I graduated in University of L'Aquila in Italy. I'm Italian, even though I have a Spanish name, because I was born in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. I did my bachelor in L'Aquila mechanical engineering, then master in energy engineering at the University of Florence. Then I moved to Belgium for my master's thesis here at the Van Kerman Institute to learn more about fluid mechanics, and I never left since then. And now I'm a professor here, where I teach several courses on fluid mechanics, on signal processing, data-driven methods, and machine learning.
Really, really good. You also did your PhD. What was the PhD all about?
My PhD was, I did it here, and was about the instability of an industrial process, which is called the jet wiping process. Is a galvanization process. Typically, you have a plate that you dip into a bath of molten zinc. You withdraw at a certain speed, and then you remove the excess of liquid with what they call an air knife. So you have an impinging jet that controls the amount of thickness that you have in this plate. So there's a lot of fluid mechanics on the impingement of the flow, on the liquid film. It's a multi-phase flow. There's a lot of thermal problems because the zinc is, of course, very hot. Mm-hmm. The gas is cold. And there are several interesting instabilities that develops. And my thesis was about understanding these instabilities.
Why did you decide to do a PhD in the first place? Because next question is then going to be, does a PhD make sense for some students? And when does it not make sense to do a PhD? So what was your reason to do a PhD? Just being an inquisitive individual, or what was it?
It's a combination of things. Curiosity, of course, was one of the main things. And then I was lucky that I had what we call here the master program here at the Van Kerman Institute, which would really start to, let's say, do a bit of research. So to enter into the world of research, and I liked that, and I was more curious about that, so I wanted to know more. That was one thing. So just learn more about these things. And the other was, to some extent, to complete my background, my skills, my technical skills, but also on the soft skills. I saw the PhD as a unique opportunity to learn many things, and so I wanted to take this opportunity.
Really cool. So when do you advise people maybe not to do a PhD? What skill sets do you need to bring? Of course, you need to be motivated, you need to be dedicated, but I think motivation enough is not enough to actually do a PhD. You also need to have the discipline, right, to do it, maybe to do it 3 to 5 years. So what do you think are the prerequisites to do a PhD, and when does it not make sense? Maybe is the question.
That's a very difficult question. I think it's a very personal experience, in the sense that you will not find two PhDs that share the same opinion and the same path towards concerning that. I think to do a PhD means to put yourself into a big project, so at the front line of a specific topic. Means then trying to develop all a set of skills that you need to face in the intermediate challenges that will take there, and you have to be somehow interested or have an interest to bring knowledge forward in a specific domain. To me, in principle, it makes sense all the time. I mean, for everyone to do a PhD, for everyone who's keen to learn a lot, let's say, and to put itself on the frontiers of a specific field. Now, it does not mean that you have to do a PhD. Mm. I know many, many wonderful engineers that 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 don't have a PhD and can do a fantastic job. So it's difficult for me to set a threshold, but maybe what I will say is that the PhD is somehow boosting all your skills. It's 3 or 4 years, depending on the countries in which you are on your own. You have to face a problem. You have someone who accompanies you, who helps you, but it's your thing, your project, your stuff that you have to bring in all these aspects, from the screws that you use in your facility to the Python code that you have to develop to process the things, to the whole things. Whereas in industry, for what I've seen, you mostly work on someone else's project, and then it takes you more time before you get into your own thing, let's say.
Yeah, maybe it's not generalizable, but do you think you have more creative freedom in your PhD? Depends probably also on the supervisor, right?
Yes, it depends a lot on your supervisor. All in general, yes, I would say. But well, let me be clear on this. I don't have enough experience in industry, so I feel I don't want to, let's say. I don't have that other side of the perspective. I mean, I've been working with many industries, doing consultancies, and with many companies. So I saw what I saw from this side. I've never been on that side, so I can mostly say what I see on this side.
Yeah. So let's assume someone wants to do their PhD, maybe even a second master's at VKI, maybe like their first master's. Do you have different programs here at VKI? Maybe you could explain quickly what these programs are and how people could actually apply for them.
Sure. So we have three main programs here at VKI. One program is the short training program, which is dedicated to usually undergraduate students that they come maybe here for their bachelor thesis or master thesis, mostly master thesis, but mm-hmm. we do have also some bachelor. Sometimes it can happen that there's also a PhD student that wants just to come here for a few months to work on a specific facility or on a specific project. But mm-hmm. this is a program that can go anywhere from 3 to max 6 months. And you focus on a project, you just work on a specific project. Then we have the Research Master Program, which is a 9-month program where we also give courses, very specialized courses, let's say. So it's at the master after master level, mm-hmm. where people specialize into experimental fluid mechanics or numerical fluid mechanics in various areas of fluid mechanics. Here at VKI, we touch a broad range from hypersonics to laminar flows in lubrication. And in that you have a degree also, which is associated to that. It takes 9 months. And this, you have half of your work is spent on a project and half is spent on courses. And then we have a PhD program, which is a 4-year program, which is usually carried out in collaboration with Belgian universities, but not necessarily. Sometimes we have also other universities from US or in Europe, but that it's a classic PhD, let's say, but as you will find it in the university, but usually here you tend to work on more more applied problems, mm-hmm. let's say.
What would you say is the most or the coolest thing, the most fascinating thing, most rewarding thing as a professor, and the most frustrating thing when working with students, for example, or PhD students?
There are many rewarding things, more than frustrating things, mm-hmm. unfortunately. The main one I would say is when you see the student grow, mm-hmm. when you see the student take ownership of the problem, ownership of the challenge, and you know, let's say, live it and really fight for it and do things to make sure that you reach the goal, that you reach the target. So the development, I would say the development of the student is probably the most rewarding part. You see that somehow you direct the growth, hopefully in the right place. Frustration, well, that's difficult, but I think that one thing that, let's say, one worry that one could have as a professor, as it follows a student, is not being able to understand the student, because mm-hmm. every student is different, yeah. and every student has different feelings, different ways of living this experience, and different priorities, and you have to be good at understanding where the tree, it's like a little tree that wants to grow. You have to understand where it wants to grow and help this grow. And if you don't understand it immediately, you might damage the tree, you know, yeah, yeah. you might damage the little plant.
Yeah. Some students I know that I also got that question is, when do I know when to ask a question? to my professor. Sometimes I might feel if I ask that question, it might come off a bit stupid. Should I ask as many questions as I possibly can? Or should I maybe find out on my own? Because I think it's in as a student the same as in business. If you don't ask questions and if you don't get boundaries from your supervisor, from someone else who has done it before, it feels like you make the same mistake. Okay, you learn from it, but it takes you so much time sometimes. So where do you see the balance of, okay, I can ask a question, and when is it annoying, quote unquote?
It's very rarely annoying, I would say, in my experience. So I encourage to, let's say, to err in the excess, better to ask more than to ask less. And then I think that to some extent, the relation between a PhD and a supervisor is something that is built with time. So maybe at the beginning, you might feel as you are asking too many questions and that you feel insecure or whatever. But things develop natural. If you have a good relation with your supervisor and you clearly have know that you're going in the right direction, at some moment you will stop even thinking about that. You see, things will become natural during a meeting. Maybe you ask we ask a question together, right? We try to get to the questions together and we try to see how to get there and so on and so forth. So I would say better to err in the excess, ask more than less. And then probably it's through the relation that things will develop. And I would say soon after a short time, you hopefully will know yourself where is the boundary, let's say. You get it into it naturally.
Yeah. What would you say, like maybe your top three tips for students when pursuing a master or PhD level? What would you give them as advice? Like some learnings from your own PhD maybe as well. Fail fast, fail often maybe, something like this?
Yes, I think failing and doing mistakes is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. It's the most rewarding experience. It's where you learn the most. Mm. If you don't fail and if you don't do mistakes, you're not learning. So for sure, doing the mistakes is important. Be open-minded, I would say. Many people start a PhD thinking that they are going to academia, that PhD is only for those that then go to academia. And this is far from true. I think we have many PhDs that then end up in industry and go to work somewhere else. A PhD is more about developing a set of skills to solve big problems. And this is relevant in industry, in academia, or anywhere else. So be open-minded, do mistakes, be okay with mistakes. It's part of the learning. And don't be maybe too hard on yourself. Sometimes a student sets the bars too high, sets the objective too high, and this can result into frustration.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the question now is for me, what resources do you generally recommend to students? Because some students, they love reading books, and I see behind you, there's the latest book, Data-Driven Fluid Mechanics, from you and some other colleagues,
yes,
which we're also going to put a link down in the description so people can check it out. Bought it myself as well. Super nice to read, by the way. I haven't gone through the whole material, but it's basically derived from a course that you also do here at VKI, which we'll talk about in a bit. So what resources do you generally recommend? Is it just a combination of different things? Is it learning from the expertise of your supervisor plus books plus internet videos, for example, YouTube videos? What would you recommend them not to do?
I think the main way of learning things is to be driven by problems. So to give yourself a problem.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, maybe you give yourself a simple problem, then a slightly harder, then a slightly harder, and then harder and harder and harder. Put the problem at the center. And once you tackle the problem, you will start needing a set of tools. Books, of course, are a must, as the main source, of, at least in my case. YouTube videos nowadays, you can find an impressive amount of material that was not available, not even at my time. So you can find many resources online. You can, the amount of information that you can get through all of these channels, books, videos online, this is fantastic, but it can be overwhelming. If you just focus on the idea that you need to gather knowledge before you tackle a problem, I think this would be a mistake because there's simply too much.
Yeah.
But if you're driven by a problem and maybe you have some advisor or someone who drives you towards what could be the tools to get to that solution, then I think the learning experience is much more enjoyable and much, much nicer.
Yeah, definitely. When we go back to your thesis, you said you worked on instabilities. So what kind of instability was that? Maybe to go a little bit into the area of fluid mechanics, and then also talking about industrial fluid mechanics, I think that would also be super interesting, like real problems and not like students working on the pipe floor or whatever. And maybe you can talk about the instabilities first, and then we'll move over to industrial fluid mechanics.
Yeah, so my problem was about an instability that originates when the jet impinges on this liquid, as I was saying. So yeah. It's a very complex problem because you have very high speed flow for the jet, usually almost Mach 1, so let's say 250, 270 meters per second, things like that. So very high speed in a slit, which is usually 1.5 millimeters. And the liquid film can be of the order of maybe 30 microns. So you have a huge gap of scales between the scales of turbulence, the scales of the liquid, and so on. It cannot be simulated right nowadays. I mean, this is something which there's no CFD. There's no handbook solution, let's say. And what we saw is that basically this instability manifests as an interaction between the jet and the liquid. And this was at the beginning postulated because it could not be simulated, could not be seen in the lab. There are no experimental techniques that can handle so easily 480 degrees Celsius for the liquid. So it's a very complicated environment. So no experiment, no way of seeing things, but there were many theories behind what could originate this instability. So what we learned from previous works was that usually in some condition, the jet might start to oscillate. And since the jet is wiving, is what is controlling the thickness of the plate, if the jet starts to oscillate, then you will see waves. And the industry came to us because of these waves, when you don't want to have these waves. Mm. One way to limit them was to reduce the speed, but this reduced also the production line. So the question and my big problem on that was, what generates these waves? And I had a very good guidance from my supervisor, Professor Buchlan, who really guided me towards trying to take a very complex problem and break it into simple problems that could be solved more easily, and then maybe try to find the patch to link them. So we established an experimental procedure where we break the problem into small ones. So first we studied dedicated facility how a jet responds to disturbances on a liquid film which impinges on that. Then we studied, we replaced the liquid by a solid membrane that could be controlled, whose shape could be controlled by us, but not be influenced by the jet. So we were imposing the shapes. And then we went back into the jet wiping facility. So we break the problem into different parts until we understood how this instability was originating, let's say.
Got it. So when we go back to this industrial problem, how do you tackle it? Is it just divide and conquer if someone from the industry comes to you? How do you approach such a problem? Because there is no, as you said, like book solution out there of this of these cases. So how do you personally tackle that? How do you start a project like this?
I think the main heart is really that of breaking the problem into simpler one, simplifying. If you see someone who has a lot of experience in that, is someone who knows how to simplify. Because the full problem cannot be tackled. Usually when industry comes to see us, they've already tried several other solutions. So you will never be able to tackle those kind of problems in their full complexity. So try to divide it, then find, of course, well, after you've divided, you're always with the question, yes, but we have decoupled this interaction. So how is this interaction in fact happening? You removed it by separating the two things, and so then the work is to try to see how the two things could have interacted. But at least you understand one thing at a time, let's say one problem at a time.
It's really fascinating because Milovan Peric said exactly the same thing in his podcast when he had like a FSI problem of a ship design, and he was actually also saying the same thing, dividing the problem and just tackling the simple things and then trying to find out from first principles where the problem actually lies. That's super interesting to hear that again from you, Miguel. So it's really, really cool.
I'm happy that I have the same opinion of Milovan.
Yeah, really cool. And when we talk about the experimental techniques, could you maybe name some of them that you've used personally? And we've even had in the coffee break the discussion of like PAV and PTV, the differentiation. I think some people don't even know what PTV is in the first place. Maybe you could explain the limitations of PAV and what PTV brings to the table.
Yes. So in my thesis, I used mostly optic-based techniques. So flow visualization, of course. So you typically illuminate, you see the flow, normally you see the flow with seeding particles, then you illuminate it with a laser. And then depending on how you acquire the images, you can enter very different worlds. So when you, we call flow visualization acquisitions that usually have a large exposure, so you don't really see these particles, you just see like smoke, quote, quote. And so you see the macroscopic scales of things, in our case, the jet, for example. You can combine this with image processing and then maybe, for instance, in our case, find the position of the jet, how it is flapping, what frequency, what amplitude, and so try to extract quantitative information from there. Similarly, you can have what we call sometimes laser tomography. So you illuminate always with a laser a liquid film, for instance, in which you have diluted a fluorescent to produce fluorescence emission, which usually happens at a wavelength that is different from the one that you're using for the illumination. So then with optical filters, you can separate what is the laser from the fluorescence in the liquid. And so you can see the liquid with a lot of contrast. And from there, use image processing to get, for instance, the interface, how the interface is moving and things like that. So this is what I call quantitative flow visualization. So visualize and then use image processing. I use the laser absorption methods to characterize the thickness of the liquid film. So here it's also an optical technique. You measure the thickness distribution of a liquid film from the amount of light that it absorbs from a backlight. So you will typically acquire images on the dry wall, see how much light you have. Then when the liquid is on it, you see how much light is missing. And you can relate this to the local thickness here in your domain. And then when it comes to PAV or PTV, so this is a special case of, let's say, flow quantitative flow visualization technique. You usually use a laser sheet, at least in the planar version. Nowadays, you have also a lot of 3D techniques. And the idea is that you seed the flow with particles, as you do for the flow visualization. But now you acquire at much shorter exposure. It's a bit as if you take a picture of something that is moving very fast. You need to, if you want to see it and distinguish it, you need to expose it for very short time, right? Otherwise, the image is blurred because of the motion. So PAV or PTV is about freezing the motion of small particles in these images so that then you can compute the velocity of these particles and build flow fields from experiments. Now, what is the difference between PAV and PTV? It's just in the way you treat the images. So in PIV, you typically divide the video, the images into small windows or voxels if you go 3D, and you try to get an average motion within that window, that interrogation window, and you usually do that through cross-correlation. So you are averaging in that window. The window can be made quite small, but you still need to have enough particles to average. So there is a limit. You cannot really make it very small. PTV stands for particle tracking velocimetry. It means that you're not going to average anything. You're going to track each individual particle. And so it would be a Lagrangian measurement. So you really track all of them. It is usually more difficult. In the past, you could do that only if the seeding was sufficiently low. Nowadays, we can use particle tracking on very dense images. So it means that you have much more points not averaged everywhere in your domain.
Got it. When it comes to the evaluation of these results, then you probably have a ton of data. Is there any specific software that you use? Have you developed it yourself? Are there open source software packages out there? How did you approach that problem?
Both things. So there are many open source packages. For instance, when it comes to PAV or PTV, there are really amazing tools on Python or MATLAB. And we mostly use them off the shelf with very minor modifications sometimes here and there, but very minor. Other which are much more specific, like light absorption, for example, is not as common as PAV. On that, we really had to develop our own codes, our own things. Same for the quantitative flow visualization. It was very specific to look for a specific jet doing those specific things, let's say. And this is part of the challenges that I was referring to when I was talking about PhD. So PhD, you need to have a big question. Why is this jet flapping and why is this happening? But to solve those big questions, you have many intermediate small things and you have to get down to code your own things. And then another big challenge that we have when we go to PTV, for example, is that because you don't have velocity points in a grid, it becomes more difficult to compute quantities such as vorticity, or you know, to take derivatives or things like that. So in that case, handling data on an unstructured grid is not trivial. It's still an active field of research, and we've been developing tools to do that, to using machine learning techniques, about which maybe we will talk later, to somehow try to get all this quantitative information without the need of a grid.
Yeah, that's interesting. The code is called SPICY.
Yes, so this code is called SPICY. We have recently submitted in the to the JOS, the Journal of Open Software, mm-hmm. and we created we have the GitHub repository. We are now creating a small YouTube course to explain what's the theory behind that and also how to use it.
Really cool. Obviously, we'll also put the link down in the description for your YouTube channel, because in the coffee break we talked, I talked to Miguel on actually creating more YouTube videos and actually doing a course on hands-on fluid mechanics. So I know I said it on the podcast, so you can't chicken out right now, Miguel. So you yes. have to do it.
Yes.
Definitely. But you will talk to VKI, and then maybe let's see if people... I think people are going to be super interested in taking this course. I think you offer it once a year at VKI, right? I've taken it myself, I think, 2 years ago. Really amazing. And also, this is what the book is based on.
Yeah.
But still, there's way more to that, so... No, this is the first time announcement here on the podcast. Miguel is going to do a course. I'm going to hold you accountable, Miguel. So
yes, okay. But I mean, with your support and your experience on that, you have a lot of much more experience than me on online courses and these things. But yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah,
amazing. Cool. Let's see. Really cool. That brings us to the next topic of data-driven fluid mechanics. So what is it in the first place? I know a lot of haters will watch this podcast saying it's only curve fitting. We talked about that before. So maybe let's describe in your own words, what is data-driven fluid mechanics? Why is it so essential to work with data-driven fluid mechanics? And why has it gained such, let's say, prominence in the last years?
So data-driven fluid mechanics, well, as data-driven whatever, and data-driven engineering or data-driven whatever is, the use of methods from machine learning or data analytics applied for problems in fluid mechanics. Now, I understand why there are many haters, because of course the word the data-driven fluid mechanics might sound weird. Of course, fluid mechanics has always been driven by data, experimental or numerical data. It's still one of the fields that has probably the largest amount of empiricism. Let's say there are many unclosed, unsolved problems for which we do need data. And we've been doing that since the early days. I mean, the example that I like to give to my students is if you take a boundary layer theory and the works of the giants like von Karman or Prandt, they always end up having a certain level of empiricism. It's unavoidable. This is true for a mixing length model to a K epsilon model. You always start with from some physics, some conservation laws, some first principles, some very sound physical knowledge. And then you arrive at a moment in which you need to fit something. So in the case of the boundary layer profile, my favorite example is the famous constant, von Karman constant, 0.41. That's an example of fitting. That comes from a long chain of physical reasoning. So you start by saying there should be this mixing length that should be linearly proportional to the distance from the wall. Then out of that, you develop. Physics takes you to the final point where you end up into a logarithm curve. But then you have to fit this curve. Mm-hmm. And this has always been done using classic ad hoc solutions. And now with machine learning, you start having more tools to fit more complex model, to better understand the uncertainties, the generalization capabilities of the model. So let's say more fitting power. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, definitely. When it comes to like the differentiation between all of these ML methods, we have deep learning, obviously machine learning, and then in machine learning, supervised, unsupervised learning, we have then also a separate part, which is reinforcement learning and all these kind of things. So how did you tackle your first ML project? And how did you maybe divide and conquer? We talked about this before, especially in the industrial setting, like getting the data set. Data is super messy, noisy, whatever. How do you approach such a problem?
That is also a very difficult question. It's very much problem dependent. It really depends on what is your question, mm-hmm. Because that sets the kind of data that you need and how much of it you need, and so on and so forth. So obviously, if you're tackling turbulence modeling, you might need the very high fidelity data, very detailed data that you can only obtain from DNS or very advanced measurement techniques such as PATV, even 3DPTV or things like that. But that's just one part, and probably the one niche, I would say. There are many other things, more at an engineering level, more on a simplified models, where you can use these tools and these ideas. I can give you some examples. Recently, we've been interested in developing correlations for aerodynamic efficiency in a flapping wing in conditions for which there is no empirical correlation out there. And you can use machine learning techniques to try to get this correlation on the fly, on the data, maybe while a drone is flying, for instance. Think of heat transfer coefficient in a cryogenic tank. That's another problem which we are tackling with our students. Mm-hmm. There are no correlations, not right now, and CFD cannot help you there, to predict how much heat and mass transfer happens in a tank which is partially filled with the liquid and its vapor. And maybe you shake it and thermal mixing happen and you can have a strong heat and mass transfer. And this can have a strong pressure fluctuations in the tank. And you don't want them. And the only solution right now is to maybe vent some of this liquid. And this is very precious cryogenic liquid. You don't want to vent it. So you can try to build a machine learning model that finds these coefficients from the data online while the tank is sloshing. And there are many other examples which I will give. And what I can say is that in all these problems, the divide and conquer strategy has always been write down a physical model, try to use physics as much as you can, go to the final equation where you will have conservation of mass, momentum, energy, whatever, and learn to live with the unknown, leaving it as a coefficient. Maybe it's a heat transfer coefficient, maybe it's a skin friction coefficient or a drag coefficient or something like that. And then use your expertise in physics and machine learning to close this problem. But the machine learning is always coming as a complement to the physics, not to replace it.
Yeah. That also probably brings us to the question of, we talked about this also in the break, is CFD had the same problem back then where people were thinking, okay, no experiments anymore. We have CFD. It's going to solve everything. We're going to be the happiest engineers ever. And now data-driven methods come along. So do you think it's, as you said, a complementary method to experiments and CFD? It kind of sits in between. It's more like a productivity slash enhancement tool for engineers, or where do you see it sitting now on the spectrum?
Exactly as you said, I think it really sits in between. It's a set of complementary tools, yeah, that you need to integrate with the existing one, with engineering and physics. So often I'm asked whether this would replace that or things like that, but my answer is generally no. I don't think, at least in the foreseeable future, that there will even be a competition between these things, because they're, I usually, at least in my work, we use it for very different things. I never had a situation where I could say, for this I will use physics, or for this I will use machine learning. Mm-hmm. It's always, I can use physics up to here, and then I need machine learning to give me that extra step.
Yeah. When we talk about that extra step, what was that, for example? Maybe you have specific scenarios where you could say, I used a data-driven method, didn't know what to do, and then machine learning helped me to explore maybe, or to extrapolate in a specific area, just to help me understand what's happening in a specific area, which I couldn't predict using a physics-based model such as CFD.
If I take, for instance, the case of the sloshing of this tank, yeah. Right now, there are no CFD models, not reliable CFD models that could predict this. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of whether I do CFD or I do something else. So we're back to the lab. We try to get the data, and we try to get a lot of it. And we try to use our knowledge in scaling laws and dimensionless analysis to make correlations, let's say, generalize or respect scaling laws and properties that we know as fluid mechanics should hold. And so in that case, the extra step could be, for instance, try to find these correlations such that your model can then be used to make predictions, controls, or something like that, and then maybe integrate it with CFD. In my experience, I really I cannot imagine a case where I could really say I was in doubt whether I should use one or the other. I don't know if this answers your question.
It definitely answers. It comes back to the complementary thing. Yes. Basically, kind of choose one or the other, or it complements each other.
Yes.
So I think that makes sense. So the question then is, who can profit from that? Like, cui bono, as we said before, who profits? Because I think there is this perception of, well, I have 5 data points, I can use machine learning now. Or like in the industry, people probably don't have the right amount of data, maybe not the goal in mind, the business use case, or maybe a specific KPI in mind that they want to be optimizing for. And then maybe they overestimate what AI can do, because we have seen what OpenAI and DeepMind are doing. They use like a brute force approach, as I always say on the podcast, to use a ton of machines, solve a specific problem, very niche application. But in engineering, in the industry, you usually don't have these big machines, or you don't want to spend millions of dollars running or training an ML model. So what is the optimal use case, and when should I use it as an engineer?
Let's say the first, who would benefit from that? I think everybody was sufficiently open-minded and knows enough about the two things. So what I see now, but I think this is also happening in the case of CFD in the 90s, as you were mentioning, is a lot of extremism, right? Saying either it's just cool fitting, I don't want to go into that, or why should I use the machine learning if I already have the simulation in the first place? Maybe we can talk about that that question also later. I think if you start getting extremist positions, you are not you're going to have troubles.
Yeah, definitely.
This is one thing. And the other thing is about be careful on what are the expectations and what you can expect. Mm-hmm. This is a very delicate point, very delicate, because of the way machine learning has been always developed from its initial development. Machine learning has had success because it was able to learn things, let's say to learn functions, to interpolate. We're talking about interpolation, if you want, or regression or whatever, to find functions for things for which there was no other way but experience. And experience, when I say experience, I mean data. Mm-hmm. So think of, for instance, I don't know, recognizing a cat from a dog. There is no conservation law that can tell you this is a cat, this is a dog. And the fact that you can learn this decision boundary in a very high dimensional space of all possible images by just using data gives you an idea of how powerful these methods are. But then when you go into physics, into engineering, you obviously don't want the machine learning to reinvent the wheel. You know that there are things that should happen, conservation laws or things like this. So finding this marriage between the two is not easy. Me, I will simply say, encourage people to be skeptical on things that are promising machine learning ways to completely replace the physics. I'm always very skeptical about those things. And my main advice would be to be open enough, try to learn enough from these two things to find opportunities. Be open-minded, let's say.
Yeah, I think it's also advice for PhD students, like in general, as we talked about in the early days, but I think open-mindedness in general is, I think, a very good approach. Because even on Twitter, when you post something about physics informed neural networks, and then people are already waiting to just come in and say, well, of course it has to be physics informed, and where's the physics, and the neural network can't learn physics in the first place. So I think this is very essential to maybe know the limitations, but also know the big advantages that these methods bring, which brings us to the point of physics. So how do you actually, maybe you have a specific use case in mind that you've worked on, how do you embed physics into a neural network?
There are many ways. One way is, if you want, architectural. So make sure that the network cannot mess up too much because you are constrained it so much, architecturally speaking, that it cannot really mess up. And I will give you an example. Another is through the learning itself. So you could try to put constraints in the learning or penalties. And that's much easier. And that's what physics informed neural network do. So you penalize the network for not respecting certain things. Okay. I would say this, so either architecturally or in the learning process. Now, I want to give an example of architectural and an example of penalty. So in a recent work on thermal turbulence modeling, for example, a student of mine, Matilde Fiore, developed an artificial neural network to predict the turbulent heat flux in a low prand, so liquid metal fluid. It's a very challenging problem, precisely because of the low prand. So there's a lot of diffusion, a lot of conduction, which messes up with the convection. And so there are many constraints that you need to impose to this network that comes from physics. For instance, you know that on average, heat goes from high temperature to low temperature, mm-hmm. and not the other way around. Yeah. You know that your model should not depend on how you place the axis in your simulation and things like that. So what she came out with was an architecture that had all this constraint enforced architecturally. So the network could not violate the second principle of thermodynamics, could not violate the Galilean invariance and things like that, just because of the way it was structured.
Yeah.
An example of constraints in the training, you might instead go for penalties. For instance, predictions that tend to violate physical principles could be heavily penalized, so that then during the training, the network does not go in this direction. But there is another word, because you can go for penalties or constraints. So penalties means that what it means, you penalize, but does not mean that the network will actually care about that penalization. It's always difficult to say how much do I penalize.
Mm-hmm.
And constraint is about adding Lagrange multipliers and making the learning process, which is already very complex, even more complex. So these, I think, are still open fields, I would say.
Yeah. How do you see the future then evolving? What's your future vision for these networks to be able to perform better, even faster? Or where do you see like the maybe even the limit of these networks? Do we even need to solve, I don't know, a whole aircraft in like, I don't know, 2 minutes, 3 minutes by training a neural network? Is it even useful?
The topic of accelerating CFD using neural network is a topic on its own. Mm. And there are interesting developments. It's not my field, so I don't want to say bad things there. But it is a topic on its own. I think they can contribute in various areas. In what I call the data generation process, which is CFD, for example, make the CFD go faster. In accuracy, so try to find a closure which is better than an existing model for a specific case. And then I would say in the use of the data once it has been already, let's say, post-mortem, once the data is there, so you try to have a network that can then lead to faster prediction, so somehow to replace the CFD. I see potentials in each of these. So on the case of improving models, it was the case of turbulence modeling, as we just said. So try to, the fact that you now have more muscles and more structured tools to calibrate models gives you more avenues towards better models. Accelerating CFD is a topic on its own. It's about trying to see to what extent you can alternate, for example, between a prediction from the real CFD or from a surrogate. So there is a lot of work going in this direction to make the CFD go faster. And then there is one which is often linked to the question that people ask, but why do I need a neural network if I have a lot of CFD mm-hmm. on its own, which is what I call, let's say, post-mortem usage of this data, which is what you can see, some sort of dimensionality reduction or englobing or assimilating all the simulation that you have done into a network. Imagine I have billions of simulations of the flow past an airfoil, and then you come and you give me a new design. And maybe this new design is very similar to another one, which I have already run. So I can just take from my chef the simulation which I did, and maybe the two that are closer, and either relaunch another CFD or try to interpolate between them or things like that. But this implies that you need to store all the simulations which you have ever done. Instead, you could train a network to somehow try to make this archiving job for you. So the network could learn, let's say, out of all these simulations and then offer you a fast prediction without you having to redo the simulations or things like that. So generate new data, there is avenue there.
Yeah.
Accelerate the process, so accelerating the process of generating data, improving accuracy of existing models, and also post-mortem treatment, let's say, of the data.
Yeah, I think that was a perfect summary, Miguel. I think we can extract it as a separate clip and put it on YouTube and chop it up. A very good summary. I think also there's this misconception of, especially when you do aerodynamics analysis of a plane or of a car, for example, in the wake region, I think sometimes people have the misconception that I have the CFD simulation already. Why would I predict something I know? Not knowing that you actually train the model with the training data, and then you have to test data to actually test the model, and actually the deep learning models do a very good job of predicting something that has not been seen before. Like you change the the angle of the spoiler, for example, it would still predict something very accurately, which I think is super fascinating, as we talked about cats and dogs. But then something for engineering, this might become like a simple use case in the future as we evolve and move towards even more powerful techniques. But the question is, there's this millennium problem, like solving turbulence or solving turbulence, for example. Do you think that machine learning or deep learning methods will help us engineers to find new ways to solve problems, even solving turbulence, whatever that might mean? And if it, is it even useful for us engineers to solve a specific problem like turbulence, for example?
Yeah, well, as you said, solving turbulence can mean many things.
Yeah.
An example that we call, that I was mentioning, we can nowadays predict the pressure drop in a pipe, even if we don't understand the finest turbulence scales and the finest things that, that are going on in such a complicated and inherently multi-scale problem.
Mm.
So there are different scales to this answer. So I don't know to which degree these tools can go towards solving turbulence in the sense of having a predictive model that can work on any geometry, any configurations, or any situation.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. I'm skeptical mm-hmm. in this direction. I don't think that you will have AI tools that can promise this, at least within the near future. Nobody knows what can happen in 30 years. But it can help you solving practical problems, right? Like finding closure, finding coefficients, finding things that can be used for your problem. And what I expect as a trend is that you might end up having models that performs much better than the ones that we've been using so far, simply because the calibration tools that are used for these models are more powerful. I think having the expectation that a tool which is developed for, say, a pipe flow can generalize to flow separation in a wing or things like that, it's very ambitious, and probably this is not going to happen in the near future. But the fact that you might have models that you know, templates that you know work in a certain kind of configuration, like you want to optimize an heat exchanger and you know that you have flow through many pipes or many bundles, you know what kind, this tool has seen already a lot of them, so maybe I can use that. I will not use the same tool maybe for flow separation past an airfoil or things like that. So knowing the bound, I will expect that you will have more tools that are more accurate within a certain range.
Yeah.
Limiting the expectation of generalization, and maybe if we refer to solving turbulence, the possibility of having one tool that fits everything, then I think this is too ambitious.
Yeah, definitely. I would probably agree on that point. Also, the question was also a bit aiming towards, some people might have seen the documentary of DeepMind, where they trained a model to play AlphaGo against Lee Sedol, like a champion basically, and there was a specific move which was like super crazy. Like the pro was thinking, okay, why does it make this move? It's super stupid. But it turned out to be such a good move that he actually learned from that AI model and became a better player himself. So the question now is, if we engineers use models that are so good that we might explore new things that we didn't think of before, because we have this complex curve fitting, but still our brain is also acting or like working in a nonlinear way, but maybe not finding problems that not that easily as compared to a neural network, although we have this powerful thing on top of our body. Do you think that engineers will be able to also learn more from AI as kind of a buddy on the side?
I think so. The case of DeepMind is an amazing case, and this documentary is amazing. Highly recommend to everyone. I think there are opportunities to learn. Now, that there we really enter into a different field of machine learning, which is reinforcement learning, which is slightly different than those that I have mentioned before. Because all the cases which I mentioned before were more in the supervising realm, where somehow you have a supervisor. So you know the answer, and you just try to, quote, quote, interpolate, even if it's not really an interpolation. But you try to, you know the answer, let's say. And you cannot expect the model to be better than the supervisor. By definition, it cannot be better than you.
Mm.
But then there is this new, I would say, it's not really new, but there's new fever into this direction, thanks to this fantastic documentary and this amazing achievement of AlphaGo. which is about to do reinforcement learning. What is the difference? You don't have an advisor. You don't know the truth. You try to learn only with the critics. It's a bit what we try to do as a supervisor to the PhD. Mm-hmm. So you don't give the answer sometimes because you simply don't have it, but you criticize, right? Without really saying, this is not really good. But I'm not telling you really in which direction, where else to search. And only in the moment you step out as a supervisor, then the student can become better than you, right? Only when in that case where the student has to find his own way, or yeah, in the case the agent has to find his own way, then you can get better things. But this is a very difficult topic. We have played a lot with reinforcement learning in fluid flows. We could have maybe a podcast only on that.
Yeah.
In general, what you often see is that controlling a flow is not like playing chess or Go. So what might end up maybe in 10 years or 15 years, I don't know, I may say something dangerous here, is that the success of reinforcement learning or these algorithms in some fields and their quote-unquote failure in others will simply redefine the scale of what we thought was difficult. So we thought Go was the most difficult thing ever. There was no way this could be trained and learned. It did. And now we are about to try to find out whether controlling a flow in certain situations is harder or less difficult or simpler. And it's a difficult question, and there's a lot of activities in this direction.
Yeah, I would be interested, how do you approach such a problem, and especially in reinforcement learning? Because I think from theory perspective, reinforcement learning is one of the hardest things to actually get into. Like, I see that you have a book in the back, Deep Reinforcement Learning in Action from Manning. I also have the same book.
Amazing book.
Yeah, it's a really good book. And yes, from the theory, like from all the formulas and actor-critic methods and all these kind of things, it's kind of complicated. So how do you take reinforcement learning plus fluid mechanics and kind of find a way to control flow? Especially when it comes to data, how do you give the reinforcement learning model the data even in the first place?
You need to know a lot about your flow if you want to try to tackle something like that. Because the way you set up the problem, the way you shape the reward, the reward shaping, really requires a lot of expertise. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people think, you know, if you put the reinforcement learning, the agent will learn and I don't have to do much work. I think it's precisely the opposite. There's so much knowledge that you have to put into that if you want to have any chance. And the way I personally see, but this is really personal view, is that most probably, and that's also the direction that we are taking with our group, is to try to go more and more towards model-based, to mm-hmm. some extent, to try to put the model. Because if you look at the way the model three works, the model three is trying to build a surrogate of the system. It does it in a very indirect way with the critic, right? The learning the value function and so on and so forth. But that, in essence, is one way of trying to build a surrogate. And it is very difficult to build a surrogate from there. It's extremely difficult. It requires interacting with the system many, many times. And what is the most frustrating thing is that you don't even know if there is any chance you can actually get it. And when you have to interact billions of times with the environment to learn something, and one environment interaction, the evaluation of one environment interaction takes a nanosecond, it's one thing. But if it takes many computer CP hours, it's not possible. You run out of business. Even doing it in a wind tunnel, where you can picture the wind tunnel as a real-time solver of CFD, it's still too slow for the kind of efficiency that you have. So the general tip is don't reinvent the wheel. If you know something, help the poor guy trying to learn the things on its own. And then try to see to what extent you want this tool to complement what you already know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Especially now for reinforcement learning and supervised learning, etc. How did you teach yourself these things in machine learning? Because I think there will be 100% a question under the video. How did Miguel teach himself this topic of machine learning? How did you get started?
Well, I think that one of the beauty of this machine learning hype or fever is that there is an explosion, an amount of excellent resources on Coursera, things of NG courses, or you can find so many resources out there that you can basically find easily almost everything you need, both on a more theoretical part, if you are more like mathematically inclined, yeah, and more on a practical part to learn, I don't know, PyTorch, TensorFlow, or this kind of tools or things. The main way I have been learning it is, as I said also to the students, is project-based, mm-hmm, problem-based. Put a problem in front of you and try to solve it using tools that you think can be solved in this way. So, yeah, that would be the main. And that's also the way I teach it. So we usually give many exercises, many problems. We give a bit of theory, we give a bit of codes of exercises, and then we assign a task. And it is through the process of phasing the task that one can actually learn.
Yeah, you're doing the exact same thing in the hands-on machine learning course, right? So how much is it for students if people are interested in the pricing? I think 150 euros.
I don't have the table in mind. Maybe we can put it in the description. Then, yeah. It depends if you're undergrad, a PhD, or
yeah, exactly.
So I don't have the table in mind. Yeah, unfortunately.
We'll post it down in the description, but I think it's definitely worth to give it a try. Either come here to VKI or take it online. I think it's also possible, right?
Remotely. It is also possible, yes.
Excellent. So actually we're approaching the 1 hour mark. Obviously, we have prepared some questions beforehand, but I'll give you a couple of questions which you haven't prepared, so it's going to be a surprise. I asked the same questions to Steve, and you ideally answer the question in one word or one sentence. So question number one is, what are you most proud of, Miguel?
My students. Nice.
And then I asked the same thing to Steve and Milovan. Are you a turbulent person? No pun intended.
Yes.
Okay. You seem to be a laminar person, actually, very calm. But who's your biggest inspiration?
I have many. It's very difficult to say. But I owe a lot to Steve and his courses and Nathan Kutz. I think his book was had a big impact on me.
Which book was it?
I think
I have the same one. I forgot the title.
It should be somewhere. It's from Oxford University Press. It was one of the... It was 2015.
MATLAB, I think MATLAB is also explained.
I
forgot the title.
It was, yes, I think it was one of the first books that had theory and then immediately codes, theory and codes, and the way it is framed really shaped a lot the way now I teach to the students. And as you can also see then later in their books with Steve, it's full of codes and things. So you and their videos also are this balance between learning something and immediately see it applied in front of you. It's something that inspired me a lot, and I owe them a lot in this sense.
Brings us to implementation speed, learning something and implementing it very quickly to see the feedback.
And then, if I may say also, I owe a lot to MIT OpenCourseWare. I've been watching old courses of Gilbert Strang, for example. Yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan. And I will sometimes people will make jokes with me that I would say like, oh, MIT OpenCourseWare is the new Netflix or something, whereas I will spend more time on the weekends just really following that and feeling again a student taking notes in front of a giant like Gilbert Strang or things was really inspiring, and you make me really think I hold them a lot, and I would like to maybe someday pay back someone else with the same inspiration and the same material, let's say.
Yeah, I like the altruism. Maybe a question in between, how much do you spend maybe hours a week on learning yourself, and how much do you actually spend teaching others?
That's a beautiful question. It varies a lot over the year, but I try to keep always a certain level of learning. Mm. Because if you teach much better if you are learning in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it means to learn if you are learning in the same time. So this helps you then to formulate the way you teach, the pace you give, the attention you give to questions, the kind of doubts that people can have. So it is very important to keep always a certain level of learning. It's not always easy. The agendas are getting always very busy. In some period of the year, sometimes I admit it's not possible to find the time to do that. But I try to do that as much as possible.
I think it's an interesting point, because I feel, from what I see at least, is that most humble professors or people working in academia are the ones who constantly keep learning and don't pretend that they know everything. I think the most arrogant people I've met in academia or in the industry are those who think they know it all. It's most of the time. And if you keep learning and know that you don't know everything, it keeps you also very grounded. and it also puts you in the mindset of a student.
Yeah.
So it kind of, you empathize with the students that you have, PhD students or master students. So I think that's a cool thing to as a takeaway from this podcast. Really, really cool. Best mentor you ever had?
I had two very good mentors. My professor here, Jean-Marie Bouclin, I think he really taught me a lot about this simplifying. He was always had this ability to simplify. And I owe a lot also to Michael Balaban, who's now a retired professor in he's a mathematician. He's been teaching PDEs all his careers. I met him already at the late stage of his career as he was retired. And I think what I got from him was really the criticism. I've been reading many papers, many things, sometimes without questioning too much certain results, certain things. He's a mathematician. I am an engineer, so our collaboration not always went very smoothly. But I owe him a lot in the ability of questioning something and, okay, take paper and pen and try to rederive these things. What limitation does it have? Are you sure that this can work and things like that? So these, I would say, the two persons who I owe the most.
Excellent. What would you say is the best tip for you to work on a hard task productively? What do you do? Is it time blocking? Is it a special method that you use?
It depends how much I like the task. Okay. If I really like it a lot, I sometimes find myself almost in trance. I don't even realize that time is passing, and I don't, let's say, have to do special things. Otherwise, I would just lock myself in this office or at home, and I don't have a very specific things. I just try to really focus. Sometimes I use the Pomodoro technique, like try to have those breaks and then make sure that during those times you don't check your emails, you don't do the things and so on. But in the moment I find myself trying to resolve to the streak, I understand that I'm not really enjoying that task. When I really am into that, my eyes become full. Like I'm completely lost and taken by the task.
That's cool. What's your favorite operating system? Maybe a redundant question, but what's your answer?
I use Windows most of the time, and I'm sorry for that.
I would have expected a different answer.
Really? Yeah. I do have Linux. I've been using Linux a lot, but now here at VGI, we're using a lot of Windows, and I'm getting used to that. There are some cool features on Microsoft, say Outlook or whatever, which I tend to use. I would say I'm more a Windows user, but it's not because I really love it or whatever. It's just because I have this and I'm okay with this.
More convenient. Got it. If you could spend one day with a celebrity, who would it be?
A celebrity?
Could be dead or alive.
Gilbert Strike. I consider him a celebrity.
Yeah, he's pretty cool. I had him on the podcast. Really humble guy.
I saw.
Really, really cool. Favorite app on your phone?
Spotify.
Nice. A video that you recorded for your own channel or in general that you enjoyed filming the most?
All the videos of Modulo, I would say. So Modulo is another open source code which we developed for multi-scale model analysis and things like this. And it was my first experience recording things. And I kind of, when I watch again those videos, I really hear myself trying and then learning how to break the video into short, because maybe you've done a mistake and you lose 3 minutes of recording or things like that. So I think I would pick those ones. Modulo videos.
Excellent skill, I think. And we talked about this as well. I think you're a natural in front of the camera, guys. Let us know in the comments. And then we'll work on this hands-on machine learning thing, as I said. But yeah.
Great pleasure.
Favorite programming language?
Python.
Nice. Favorite movie?
The Others.
Okay. Who will win the AI race? Country, or you can name a country. If there's a thing called AI race, who's going to make it?
I don't like to see it as a race and as a country, but there's a lot of development in the US and in China as well. So it's very difficult to say, and it depends on how we define the race. But at the moment, I would say China and the US are really fighting for that, I would say. Mm.
What are your concerns regarding AI in terms of it being misused?
People not understanding enough about it. I think this is something that we have to be careful about, because in the moment you don't understand, and because of the way the way it is, the achievement of AI are often phrased, they are very prone to science fiction, science fictionism, let's say. It is very easy to play with our fears, and when you scare someone, that's not good. The only solution is to know enough about what is happening under the hood.
Mm. I think people also kind of develop sometimes, not obviously not everyone, kind of this victim mentality, because they think AI is this super mighty thing that will replace all jobs, and people are going to be like, okay, I'm just a bookkeeper, whatever, and I'm just not going to upskill myself and learn more about AI, maybe to work next to AI as kind of an enhancement tool. So they just give up and don't learn anything about it. So I think a general recommendation would be to just get into it, maybe learn the basics of AI, and also see what it can do and what it cannot do. I think that's also super important. But yeah, assuming AGI, an AGI system, would be possible within the next 5 to 10 years, what's the first question you asked an AGI system?
How did you get there? I mean, how do you work?
Mm-hmm. So you got one. What is one superpower you would like to have?
Being able to read faster.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I would love to have that as well. Sometimes you read a sentence and you read it again and you read it again.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And last question, if you were a superhero, what would your name be?
Huh. I think Miguel is fine.
And Miguel sounds good.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's good. Cool. Any closing remarks or motivating words to the audience, Miguel? Then we'll wrap it up.
I would say, don't be an extremist, be open-minded, try to learn in the most impartial way as possible, and be critical, so that you can really use tools. You cannot use tools if you're not sufficiently critical about what they can do.
Perfect. With that, thank you very much, Miguel. It was roughly an hour now for the podcast. Thank you very much for inviting me into this beautiful place. And I'll have a talk in 2.5 hours, roughly, to the audience.
Yes.
Is it 2.5? No, 1.5 hour, I think.
It's a two. The talk is a two, right? So we will have maybe some time for a tour or something.
Definitely, yeah. You show me around. But yeah, can definitely recommend. Get in touch with Miguel. I'll put every link down in the description. And then, yeah, looking forward to seeing you for
but
a second time.
But thank you for coming to visiting us, and for all the coaching about the online and the novelties and the life of an influencer, let's say. It's a great pleasure, great honor, and I really thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much, Miguel.